Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 42 for August 22nd, 2013. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. So, how y'all doing? It's good to be back in the podcast chair after taking part of the summer off to do some traveling and reading and family stuff and, of course, playing tons and tons of video games. I have a huge backlog of things that I want to write about. You know, I used to worry about falling behind the sort of trampling herd of reviewers and critics writing about new games in that short window of time that we tend to pay attention to them, which is generally about a week. Now I typically post whenever I feel like I have something to, to add to the conversation. Sometimes that can be weeks or months after a game's release. At the moment, I'm actually writing about a game that's 10 years old, and I could not possibly be more excited about this project. If you haven't heard the news, a brand new publishing label officially launched yesterday called Press Select, whose mission is to publish original and unique books about video games. What we're talking about here really is a new press that's devoted to long-form video game criticism, and they've recruited some really terrific writers to produce the first round of books. If you're a regular listener, or if you follow me on Twitter, or interact with me in any sort of social networking situation, you probably know the two fine gents who are behind this project: Brendan Keough, who's been on this show recently, and Dan Golding, who I've known Dan since the earliest days of Brainy Gamer, and he is one of the brightest minds in the space. I'm not going to go any farther than that here because I'll soon post a piece with more details about the project on my site. And I'm sure I'll have Dan and Brendan on the show soon to discuss Press Select. But I will say that the book I'm working on is about my personal favorite game, The Legend of Zelda Wind Waker, which I suppose if you've been listening to this show for any amount of time, you probably already know that's my favorite game. And what a wonderful thing to be able to devote oneself to. It's a passion project. That's what it is. Something that you love, something that you'd love to have the time and the support to write about. And here I am with that opportunity. So I'm very grateful to Dan and Brendan, and I wish them all the best with Press Select. I have great, great confidence in their ability to take this, to make this a huge success. So, this edition of the podcast features a conversation with Steve Gaynor of the Fulbright Company, whose game Gone Home debuted last week to stellar reviews. I don't know how else to describe it. An outpouring of really thoughtful and sometimes very personal essays from all corners of the net. This the kind of response that I would imagine any game designer would just dearly love to have, really any artist in any media, that would just that kind of reaction where your audience comes to you and wants to engage you on your work, or wants to thank you, or wants to, in some way have a conversation with the person who made this thing that they really love. It's been that kind of reaction that you see, and also people reflecting on how the game impacted them intellectually, emotionally, and otherwise. It's just a fascinating thing to watch. Steve has been on this show many times over the years, and I know from my own observation and from my friendship with him how much he poured himself into this project. And I mean, the great professional risk that he took, leaving a really lucrative job with one of the most successful studios in the world, and basically betting the farm on a new indie studio with a very small team. So, in preparing for this interview, I wanted to, you know, to talk about the game, of course, and Steve's reaction to the response Gone Home has received. And, you know, I tried to think of questions that he hasn't already been asked a dozen times. But I also wanted to do something else that we who play and sort of consume games rarely get to do. I hope you'll stick around for the last 10 minutes or so of the show where I basically turn the tables, so to speak, on Steve and unintentionally make him squirm very uncomfortably in his seat. So keep listening and you'll see what I mean. So that's the show. As always, thank you for listening and for supporting my work here and on my website. It means a lot to me and I appreciate you sticking with me. So enjoy the show and away we go. I am delighted to welcome Steve Gaynor back to the podcast. Since you were last here, Steve, a few things happening, a few things going on.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's why I wanted to have you back on. I really appreciate you doing this. I know this has just been an insanely crazy time for you, and I appreciate you making time to chat with me.
I cannot complain about the number of appointments that I've had to talk to people. So yeah, it's been busy, but it's a good kind of busy.
So we'll talk about the game, of course, Gone Home, and a lot of the people listening to this show have probably already played it, or maybe if they haven't heard of the game and they're listening to the podcast, they may soon wish to play it. So I just want to just lay this out for everybody. The first half of the conversation will be spoiler-free, and I do think I'm not too precious about spoilers generally in game criticism, but for your game, I think it's pretty important not to say too much about details of the game if you haven't played it. And then I'll let everybody know when we get into spoiler territory, and that'll be more like the second half. Is that okay with you?
That works for me.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what the last couple of weeks have been like for you and your team at Fulbright.
I've launched games before, right? Like I've released a number of titles as part of a larger team, and even when we released Minerva's Den, you know, we were a smaller team and I was the lead on it, but it was also, you know, it was a DLC, and you know, so there were all these different factors. So this is the first time that I've been involved with launching a game that we really had full ownership over, you know, that I wasn't just a level designer, that it wasn't an expansion to a sequel or anything, but it was our thing that we made and it came out and people were really excited about it. It seems like we got some really nice reviews, and that was cool because, you know, similarly, if you're on a big project, it's still a different feeling than when a game like this gets a 10 out of 10 or a 9.5 from GameSpot or something. It's really strange. It's really kind of surreal to, you know, be like, okay, the four of us have just been in this basement office and Kate in her apartment just making this thing for the last year and a half. And now places like Polygon and IGN are treating it like it's a real thing. You know what I mean? It's odd. Yeah. From our point of view, but we're super grateful for that response, and then especially pretty soon after that, we started getting, and we're still getting. You know, it's only been a week now, but we're still getting emails and tweets and stuff from people that are just contacting us directly and saying incredibly nice things and relating the game to their life and their experience, and so just like. I guess this probably happens, but I haven't seen it myself, and so it was really cool and strange to see people writing in and just saying like, "Thank you for making this game." That is just such a wonderful sentiment for somebody to send along. And so anyway, I'm talking a lot about how much people like your game, and I guess I'm just saying we're really grateful for that.
Yeah,
it's been hectic because I've never had to deal with this many emails at one time, but. It's slowing down, and that's good.
I know you've been trying very hard to respond to people. You do it a lot on Twitter, and I'm sure you've been sending a lot of emails, which is, I think, is a lovely thing to do. And you know, it struck me, and has many times through this process since the game released, what a wonderful thing it is. I want Fulbright to have great success in the future, and maybe you'll get bigger, maybe you'll make big games, maybe you'll make small games, whatever you decide to do. But there's this kind of beautiful thing about this time when the people who make the game are right there kind of sitting beside it, and the people are discovering it and playing it pretty much all over the world, and you're right there and you're part of that conversation, and people can ask you questions, and it's a way of the way the medium works seems to me to be beautiful and precious in this little moment, and I kind of don't want that to ever change. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think there have been versions of that all along. Because, like, I remember a very cool formative experience for me was in 1997 when Fallout 1 was still in development. I had really, really been paying a lot of attention to the development of that game, and there was like review of it in PC Gamer magazine that I had read like over and over, and it was all dog-eared. And my family had gotten internet in the house just recently, like AOL or whatever. And I had found the Interplay forum, you know, the forums on the Interplay website for Fallout. And there were, you know, developers of the game that wasn't out yet that were responding to people, you know, asking about the game and saying, oh, I want this to be in the game. And like the demo came out and people talking about the demo and the developers responding. And I remember, I don't know, do you remember, the Fallout 1, there's, they released a trailer. It's one of my favorite trailers, and I just realized that we ripped it off of the Minerva's Den trailer, which is awesome. but the way it starts is you see a black and white image of kind of like 50s, you know, the Jetson-y kind of day, World of Tomorrow kind of stuff, of commercials for like a handy helper robot and all this kind of stuff, and the maybe the Ink Spots song is playing in the background. And then slowly the camera just starts to dolly back and reveal that you're watching a television. And then you see the inside of the room and it's all ruined. And then it dollies back more and you see that the walls of the building the room are in have been destroyed. And there's just a completely post-apocalyptic cityscape in the background. And then it just fades to the title. And I remember just, you know, that thing came out and I was really struck by it. And, I was on the forums with the developers and seeing people be like, that's not a trailer. I want to see gameplay. And like all the, you know, the other people being really positive and stuff and the developers responding. Anyway, it was a really cool moment for me personally as a kid to be involved in this thing with the people who were making it while it was still being made. And then for the game to come out and for it to be awesome. And a really kind of revelatory title in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, I think that kind of experience is more available now because of like Twitter, you know, and because, you know, indie developers at least just have their email addresses up on the web and you can drop them a line and all that kind of stuff. And I'm really excited to be able to see and hear people's responses to the game and then actually be able to like react to it and tell them, you know, thanks for playing and respond to their questions and stuff. It is really, really cool.
That's a two-way street. You know, the communication means that you're listening to them and they're listening to you. I'm curious what you all have learned about your game from all of the responses, and many of them very personal responses. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But what have you learned about Gone Home?
Well, we were certainly validated in some ways with some of the stuff that we decided to leave fairly vague, you know, some of the plot stuff that we left in a form that we felt was very subtle and kind of hard to pick up on, and that we were like, oh, we know that a lot of people aren't going to pick up on this, and we don't know how long it's going to take people to put these pieces together. And then, you know, within the first day, people were writing, oh, this and this, and it all adds up, and that's what this means, and doing blog posts about this stuff that we had left deeply buried. And so it was really cool to see that leaving some stuff unsaid for people to discover on their own was effective and didn't, you know, people did find it and did put it together and it was satisfying for them, but it wasn't like a surface level thing. So seeing that amount of kind of dedication to decoding the story or to doing the detective work has been really, really cool. I found it really interesting to see the reactions from people who are both very much like Sam, just like the background she has identifying with the character, but also people whose background is completely, you know, has nothing to do with Sam's, or is like a wide variation on her experience, saying that they really identified with the story for this, that, or the other reason. which, you know, we can talk more about what that means, I guess, when we're in spoiler world. But, yeah. You know, I assumed that some people would connect with it strongly and other people would see it as kind of a more universal experience for them to engage with. But I've been interested to see how specifically some other totally diverse groups of people have seen themselves in the game. It's been really interesting.
Yeah. I remember seeing you at IndieCade a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we both attended a session that Anna Anthropy hosted, a talk that she gave. And I remember, and I didn't know anything about Gone Home really at all. I mean, I didn't know what you were thinking or anything. You're being very tight-lipped about it. And you asked her in the Q&A session, as I recall, and forgive me if I don't get this exactly right, but you said something like, do you think it's possible for a straight guy to write a character who's neither straight or a guy? And do that authentically. And I recall her response was, well, she seemed a little skeptical.
Well, and I mean, we continued that conversation after the talk. Really where we left it was, she really did say, you know, you shouldn't do that, probably. She said, there's other ways to be an ally than to write a queer character. And from my own perspective, that was the point where that our points of view weren't reconcilable on that exact point, because I appreciate her perspective and I respect her point of view immensely. And I'm really glad that she was willing to take the time to talk through all this stuff for me. And we ended up at two different points, which were, you know, like in a priority level, in order of operations, like my first priority, the place I was coming from was not, I want to be an ally, therefore I want to write a queer character. It was like, I want to be a writer, therefore I want to write a good story. And it's about this character. And doing a good job at that is a very specific kind of job that you have to do. And what you were pointing at, I think, is, yeah, it takes taking the job seriously and doing your research and surrounding yourself with people who have had the actual experiences and drawing on them and other diverse resources to try to represent this character's experience in a way that's authentic and respectful. And recognize that you can't take it lightly or be cavalier about how you express this person's, you know, reaction to the events in their life. But I think that we ended up at a place where we didn't quite see eye to eye about like the boundaries of that stuff. And I know that Anna played the game and wasn't super excited about it. So, you know, she wasn't super against it either, but right. she didn't feel like it represented her, and so maybe, you know, maybe she still would have preferred that I didn't write the game. I don't know, but you know, all I could do is say, you know, we decided to create this character, and now my job is to do right by her and by people whose experience is closer to hers than mine was in the way that I write this character.
When I was in grad school, one of my teachers was this really terrific American playwright named Christopher Durang. And he used to say, you know, they tell you write what you know. And
yeah.
According to him, that's horse shit, which is a direct quote. And, you know, his theory was you should write what you want to know. You should write what you're passionate to know more about, that you should dig. Yeah. That's what makes artists interesting, is that in fact writing what you know is one, certainly that's a road that you can travel, but you don't have to. And in fact, great artists haven't over the years. Well,
the thing is, I mean, one half of it is I did write from my own experience,
of course. Yeah,
you know, half of the writing is me thinking about when I was a teenager and when I had a cool friend in high school that it didn't make any sense why they wanted to hang out with me because they were cool and I wasn't. And they introduced me to cool music and took me to my first show in the city and all that kind of stuff. And then also, you know, my now wife, Rachel, who I met in high school, liking her so much and falling in love with her and not knowing if she felt the same way and the ups and downs of that. And we were in a long distance relationship and had to be apart and all that kind of stuff. And then the other side of it is who Sam is and the additional factors of her sexuality and her position in society. And, you know, from that, for me, it was really a lot of research, you know, of like reading all of the blogs that I could and all of the books, you know, nonfiction and fiction books that I can, and especially original research, as in interviewing people. So I interviewed people that my wife knew in grad school, and it's actually how I met Kate Craig, because I knew her wife, Emily Carroll, as an artist, a fan of hers, and I followed her on Twitter. And when we were starting this project, we decided to meet up because she was going to be down here for the Stumptown Comics Festival. And I interviewed her about her experiences when she was a teenager. And she brought Kate along with her and was like, hey, would you want to talk to Kate too? So I interviewed her as well for background on the game. And at that point in time, she was also like, oh yeah, I'm a 3D artist for video games. and I was like, we need one of those.
Ding, ding, ding.
So that also started at that same table at the Doug Fir in Portland. Yeah, we started our discussions about maybe her wanting to do art for us. So, you know, all of those perspectives that I got from people's written accounts and from interviewing people and from Kate and Emily during development, it was incredibly important to start from there and not just start from, I think I get it, I'll figure it out. You know, like if you go in and you assume you know enough to get started, all you're going to be doing is regurgitating tropes that you've seen in movies and TV shows. I really had it drilled into me by Ken Levine at Irrational that if you're going to write something or if you're going to pitch something, you have to research every aspect of it before. So you know, okay, here's what this thing that I'm going, that here's what my subject is made of, right? Like here's what the real version of this thing that I'm turning into fiction, here's how it actually works. And here's what people actually experienced when they went through it. And I'm going to use that as part of the experience that I'm building. So I have to know what the reality is. You know, he applied that to very mechanical stuff. Like I was pitching him a quest for BioShock Infinite that was about like reconstruct or fix it, basically fixing a Zeppelin. And he was like, well, have you researched Zeppelins? Do you know how they work? Do you know what, how they stay up in the air? Is it like helium or is it just air in there? Or they keep it heated, you know, the whole time. And I was like, no. And he's like, all right, go research Zeppelins and then come back to me tomorrow. You know, and that's just a very small example. It, you know, made an impression on me and made me think immediately when we realized what character we were signing up to write, that I knew that I had to know as much as I could about people who had really experienced that in their life before I just jumped in and started trying to write it myself.
You know, you mentioned familiar tropes from TV and other video games and things like that. One of the things that is interesting about the game to me is the way you play with those tropes, the way you play with our, I guess better said, the way you play with our expectations about tropes, like what the horror genre is, what sort of presentation of characters you're going to get if you have the troubled teen, you know, the sort of predictable outcomes. And it's interesting to me the way you steer clear of them, but you also kind of use our expectations to kind of play with that experience. Does that make any sense what I'm saying? That you know what we think we know, and then you mess with that.
Yeah, I'm messing with you.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, yeah. Like, and some of it is so, like on the highest level, the atmosphere of the game. You know, the dark and stormy night, and the dark house, and the creaky noises, and the slightly ominous ambient music and all that kind of stuff is a gambit to inject tension into the game when we tell you outright, there's no enemies in this game. You're not ever going to be in danger. Nothing's going to kill you or anything. But we still need the game to feel like there's a sense of urgency to solving the mystery and to feel like, oh, something's not right here. I gotta find out what happened. And so we use, you know, on a basic level, we use that foreboding atmosphere of unease to make you feel like something's not right. I got to figure out what it is, even though it's just empty rooms with notes and stuff in it. You know, it's there. So that's something that we did not to mess with expectations, but just to imply the tone that we wanted you to feel you were in the middle of when you were searching the house, and not just feel like, oh, I can just, this isn't really important. I can just take my time, whatever. I'll just go, you know, I'll go up to the guest room and take a nap. I'll figure this out tomorrow. You know, like the atmosphere is hopefully telling you, I have to figure out what happened right now. But then going one step beyond that and knowing what context we had put the player into, it was then I felt effective to, in specific moments, kind of push harder on that and use imagery that you've seen in games before that you think you know what it means. And you're like, oh, good. Okay, this is finally a video game. Something messed up happened here, you know, and then reveal that what you thought you saw was not the standard video game thing. You know, like I'm specifically talking at this point about the red stains in the bathtub, which, you know, I don't know if that's a spoiler, but
well, we'll probably transition into spoiler territory here in a second. So okay. Maybe we should put the flag up now.
Sure. Yeah. We're going to talk about specific stuff about the game.
Yeah, that was my favorite. I mean, that was such a beautiful moment. And of course it segues into one of, I think, the most poignant moments in the game, that particular journal entry about the dying of the hare. Mm-hmm. And what that meant and how it felt and what was happening with those two girls at that time. And it, of course, you also have a wonderful voice actor who's giving you really a terrific, understated, but really kind of spot on. She doesn't seem like an older woman trying to pretend to be a younger woman. You know what I mean? Like you so often hear in games.
Yeah. So Sarah Grayson is the actor who played Sam, and she is a local actor. She's from here in Portland, and she is phenomenal. And voice acting is a hobby for her. She has a day job. She does distribution at Dark Horse Comics as her 9 to 5, and she has not done a lot of like dramatic voice work. And you know, we got auditions from a local voice agency, and we heard it, and we were like, she sounds perfect. And she came in, and we, you know, did the voice sessions in person, and she was just incredible, incredibly dedicated. There was one of the diaries very, very near the end of the game that is about the last show that Lonnie plays, where she like dedicates this song to her, and then she's all sad about it and stuff. And that was rough in the studio. Like, I was not prepared for the level of emotional response that she had while she was recording that. So she, you know, she really threw herself into the role and had some incredibly natural presence, and is just fantastic.
You talked in an interview with Lee Alexander recently about kind of how constraints can be an advantage. Of course, this is something artists know from forever, I guess, but your way of thinking about constraints, your game world is, you know, it's one house, but also your team, you know, you basically are four people creating a game. If you'd had six people, would you have been able to do it differently or better? If you'd had nine people, to what degree is the game a reflection of the resources you had and sort of matching those up in just the right way?
It's really a question of who we had, more so than like how many people we had. Because I mean, if we had six people or nine people, a real question would be, well, what do they do? Like, if two of those people were like character artists and animators, then that'd be a different ball of wax, right? But we started with three people, which was myself, who's a level designer and writer, and then Carla, who is a 2D artist and my story partner, and, you know, did a lot of video editing and voice recording stuff and whatnot at 2K on this project. And then Yonaman, who's a programmer, right? So that started us from a point of, we're a 2D artist, a 2D artist, a programmer, and a writer designer. And I've done a lot of placing lighting and assets and kind of dressing levels as well. So like, you know, I knew I'd end up doing that. And so it's like, okay, we have the ability here to make a game that is a level with a lot of 2D art in it and one programmer. So, you know, somebody who's one person's going to have to program everything that goes into the game. So there's only so many systems that you can put in. And so, you know, that lined up with stuff I had been like writing about in my blog for a long time and stuff I was interested in as a designer, which is, if we just make a level with art assets and story assets and voice and stuff in it, and the whole game is about you exploring the space to discover the story that happened there and uncover everything that's in the space, can we make that the whole game? You know, can we make that the thing that you're doing and make it interesting? And so the missing piece there was 3D art. You know, I don't know, I don't know what we were thinking. We'll find contractors, I guess. We'll pay people piecemeal to make us assets, or we'll just buy stuff off of the internet, you know, because there's websites where you can buy 3D assets. And it's a damn good thing we didn't have to do that, and that we found Kate early just through a complete bout of serendipity, and that she was the fourth piece of the puzzle, because her 3D art made the house beautiful. So, you know, like, we started from, for me, it's more a question of who do you have and what can you build with that, and how can that be something that's compelling? And obviously, going into our next game, we'll have, hopefully, to some degree, more so than this game, the resources to make more of those decisions out of our own desires of what we want to build versus the bare necessity of these are the people that we have that are working, willing to work for free or nearly free for the amount of time to ship this game. But at this point, our constraint becomes what we've already built, right? Because, like, it would be silly just to throw out what we have and totally start over and be like, we're going to make a, you know, space shooter trading game or something, right? Like, it only makes sense to say we've built the base of Gone Home, which kind of establishes a very extensible interactive framework, and then to decide how do we want to expand from here. You know, like, if we are going to bring on two more people, who are they and what does that allow us to do? You know, what it allows us to say, here's where we're starting, what are we most interested in exploring next, and then try to fit who's working on it to that. But I'm glad the thing we started out with is a set of core mechanics, is sort of this interactive framework for navigating a space and interacting with it and learning from it, that it feels like there are a lot of different possibilities, as you could say, we'll add this one aspect or this one aspect or expand in this one way to make it a totally new, interesting experience that also builds off of what we already have.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about how it's sort of what you don't say sometimes, or just what you hint at, that can compel players to start piecing the puzzle together. How did you strike that balance? I mean, I'm thinking now that we're in spoilers, I'm thinking of Oscar and his story, and that I'll mention this. There's a writer named Austin Walker who writes for Clockwork Worlds. Did you read his piece? I assume you may have seen it, about pieces, which is a just fantastic piece. And I had played the game more than once, because you'd given it to me in beta and at various points. And I had a sense of Oscar. I mean, I knew that there was something. But I guess I just didn't do my homework well enough. And, you know, my God, there it all is. And I felt like the biggest chump. Like, how did I possibly not get that? Like, what, you know? But then it occurred to me, this is exactly what's really cool about the medium, is that, you know, along comes this guy who thinks very carefully and plays the game again to take another look, and then he pieces the puzzle together, and suddenly he shares that with all of us, and we're like, oh damn, you know?
Yeah.
He molested Terry.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that's the thing that I was, you know, pointing at earlier, just as far as, like, we want to touch on that very lightly and leave all of the pieces there and kind of bury them for people to find. And we knew, you know, we were like, almost nobody that plays through is just gonna put these pieces together naturally. Like, especially the first time you play through, if you don't really start being the archaeologist. For us, it was twofold. It was, well, we want to leave some mysteries in the game that have very little light shown on them, and that do reward people who are paying an extreme amount of attention and diagramming everything out and you know, cataloging all of their discoveries and trying to make every connection that they can. And also, you know, that subject matter is something that I did not want to lay heavily into. You know, I didn't want it to be the focus of the game, and I also didn't want to risk handling it badly by focusing on it too strongly. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't feel comfortable with saying,
yeah,
I can really fully express the experience of these characters in this situation. I wanted to, you know, say, okay, there's evidence here of something that may have happened in the past, and it is hard to connect the dots between, but all the implications are there. And if you look at them, you can draw that conclusion and extrapolate meaning from the bare facts of, or the evidence, I guess I should say, of what may have happened. And it was really interesting. It was really cool and exciting in some way to see that post by Austin, because he did both put all of the pieces together, it was exactly what I had intended with the evidence that was there. And he also, you know, stated it. He wrote it out beautifully. And I was happy to see that all of the stuff, even the light illusions, you know, the whole, like, why Terry's novels are the subject matter that they are. Yeah. And why his last one is different than the others and all that kind of stuff. You know, like, all those, that little knot of illusions and implications and stuff was all, it was totally intentional. And I'm, but also we did not hit you over the head with it. So it was really cool to see someone reconstruct that whole picture and be struck by it and share that with
you. Yeah. And then bring that conversation to the community. I mean, it's this crazy, wonderful way that what's distinctive about this particular art form is that it, even in a single player, a deeply personal single player experience, you're still kind of in a multiplayer experience because you're going to share it not everybody's going to get everything. And so, but you know, the thing too is you wonder about Terry, you know, why does he, things rattle around in your head and you try to piece it together for yourself. So when someone else provides another piece you missed or just has a theory, it's worth thinking about. And you kind of, it rattles around in your head when you walk around in the days after playing the game, which I think is a tribute to the game's, the way that the game can compel us to carry it with us after we've left the world of the game, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it has been really cool just seeing people say, you know, oh, I was still thinking about this game for days after I finished it, which is an incredibly high compliment.
Well, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelt here because I want to ask you, I have to ask you about this secret room that I found in the game. And I haven't heard anyone mention it. None of the reviews or the essays I've read have said anything about this room. Now, do you know the room I'm talking about?
I think I might have an idea, but I could be totally wrong.
Okay, it's a little tricky to find it, okay? But here's how I did it. Okay, so you grab the duck from the porch, and then you carry the duck to the bathroom off the foyer, and you place the duck on the toilet.
Okay.
Then you flush the toilet 11 consecutive times. And if you do that, a secret panel opens up. Okay, are you with me now?
I'm definitely listening.
Okay, so apparently this room is user-generated content because when you go in there, there's a sign on the wall that says the gratitude room. And there's this answering machine there with messages on it. Okay. Now, I know you're skeptical because you built the game and this just sounds like crazy talk to you, but I can prove that this room exists by playing a few of the messages on the machine. Okay. So are you interested?
I can't pass up a secret like this.
Okay.
Hey, this is Mandre Hare from Bioware Montreal, and I want to congratulate the entire Fulbright team on the release of Gone Home. As creators, it's up to us to make the games that represent the direction we want to see the industry go in. By creating an immersive sim that is about narrative and exploration, you've shown us what direction you want to go in, and it's a wonderful direction. You put a bit of yourselves out there and told a story that is personal, touching, and beautiful. So, sincere thanks to you for a wonderful experience and for sharing it with the world. I look forward to seeing you all in the near future and wish you all the best.
That was really sweet.
Now do you believe me? Now do you believe me? This room exists. Here's another one. This one was the next message. I just kept hitting play.
Okay.
Hi, this is Ben Abraham of the Critical Distance blog, and I have a message for the Gone Home team. I wanted to thank you for making such a great game. I really, really enjoyed Gone Home. It was like no other game I'd ever played before, and it left me feeling really, really hopeful about the state of the games industry at large. I think it's a really good sign that people can make a game like this and it can receive the kind of attention that it has received and hopefully the kind of commercial success that you have hopefully seen.
Well, thank you, Ben. That's really nice. The fact that it makes people feel optimistic about people are doing with teams is incredibly, incredibly strong.
It's been a real through line in the criticism. I think it's maybe people are looking for reasons to be hopeful in an industry that can sometimes, you know, disappoint us pretty badly. Yeah, so here's another message, Steve. This player was slightly disappointed by the game.
Okay.
Hey, this is Patrick Klepek from Giant Bomb. I was actually sort of disappointed and a little angry that there were no ghosts at the end of Gone Home as a fan of horror and horror games. But that's okay. The game made me surprisingly nostalgic about my first love, even though my story is wildly different than the one portrayed in the game. I had those same passions, those same mistakes, those same stumbles with my family, and it made me very nostalgic and wistful for something I hadn't thought about in a very long time, especially in a light like that. And for that, I thank you.
That's awesome. Patrick is a great guy, and I really appreciate his taking the time to play and to spread the word to the Giant Bomb readers. It was really nice.
He's a true believer.
He wants to believe. He wants to believe there are ghosts at the end.
So I kept listening. There are a few more. This one struck me as particularly interesting because I think is indicative of the kind of response that various people had to the game that was uniquely personal. Listen to it, and I think you'll see what I mean.
Hi, this is Danielle from Polygon. Gone Home was a really special experience for me and something that really moved me, more so than any other movie or book or video game or other piece of media that I think I've ever experienced. Mostly because the story of Samantha is so very close to my own and my own personal experiences coming out and falling in love for the first time and being with a girl for the first time. It was really kind of amazing to see this reflected in a game and reflected with such emotional honesty. It was the first time I've ever seen myself in a video game character, and that was a very powerful experience.
That is, that response is incorrect. For someone to say that about that they never had experience like that in any medium before, it is hard to fathom. I don't know how to react to something like that. That's awesome, and it does make me very happy to hear someone say that they really identified and saw themselves in something that we made. And it does make me feel proud that we did it in a game, because I don't know, games have not spent a lot of time in this space, which is something I recognize. And I'm really grateful that people feel like we did a good job with it.
You've not met her. I hope someday you will. But my wife is playing the game with me, and she never plays any video games with me, and
yeah.
I'm a little too old for the game in the way that some people have responded, that kind of what it was like to be that age in the 90s, but she was born in 1974, and
she's right on the edge of the Gen X,
exactly. Yeah, she's very interested, and she's taking it very slowly. Every night she says, "Are we going to play Gone Home?" And that like never happens to me, I got to tell you. So, yeah. Now, you know why this room's called the Gratitude Room, right? It's this hidden room. So you're not just inspiring players, though. You're also inspiring other developers. Here's one.
Hey guys, it's Nels. Congrats again. I just wanted to say how commendable it is that you all took the language of Immersive Sims and used it to create something so tangible, so intimate, and so genuine. Gone Home is tremendously inspiring and has already made ripples that I know we're going to feel for years. And I can't wait to see what you guys do next.
A quick editor's note, that was Nels Anderson from Clay Games, FYI.
And that is also awesome. Yeah, it definitely speaks to what we wanted to do, which was say we come from this background of working on these immersive sim games, or especially, you know, being inspired by all the ones that came before the BioShock series, and being inspired in our own work by the BioShock series, and, you know, Thief and System Shock and Deus Ex. And saying if we took the aspects of those games that inspire us and we pared down a lot of the kind of maximalist tendencies that have occurred in that genre, and we tried to put it in a different different fictional context or a different, you know, kind of experiential context than those games have done before, would it still be engaging, or would it still feel like it comes from the place that our inspirations come from? The cool thing is, at least to me, is that most people who play it have there's no reason to have any knowledge of where our inspirations come from or what our stance is, you know, like why we made the game the way that we did. And it's just the experience that it is. But yeah, hopefully if you're as familiar with the games that led to Gone Home as we are, there's this layer of, I don't know, is intertextuality a word that makes sense there?
Yeah.
of talking with this sort of design legacy, and seeing how this is another piece of the discussion of what designing games that way means.
We mentioned earlier Austin Walker, who wrote one of my favorite pieces on the game. I thought, you know, maybe he'd want to give the answering machine a call. And
how many of these are there?
Turns out he did.
It is hard to listen to this answering machine. You theater and stuff, like you put on productions. Isn't it hard when somebody comes up to you and just says really nice things?
You have to listen.
All right.
You're being forced to receive the gratitude.
I can't escape the gratitude.
No, you cannot, because you're in the gratitude room.
Out of gratitude towards what you do with your podcast and your work is meant to me, I will continue pressing.
Hey, Fulbright Company. This is Austin Walker from ClockworkWorlds.com. The other day I was telling my dad about Gone Home, about the characters, the plot, the mechanics, the music, about how that house was haunted, even if it really wasn't. At one point, he asked me if I thought someone would copy you guys. I thought about it for a minute and said, man, I hope so. I can't wait to see what Gone Home will inspire others to do, and I'm already excited for what you all will do next. Keep up the good work.
That's really sweet. If people draw something from our game and want to incorporate it into their work, I take that as the highest compliment. Somebody that I know, Joel Burgess, who works at Bethesda and was the lead level designer of Skyrim, and he played early playtests, and he was like, the countdown till that putback mechanic shows up in another game is starting now. Which, you know, like, we would be incredible, you know, we would, like, you know, we would take it nothing but a compliment if a system like that became something that we saw in other people's work. But, you know, so much of what's different about Gone Home, I think, is the specific content that we put into what is really a very straightforward interactive context. It makes people think about what kind of stuff that they could address with the game that they're making. That's also really awesome.
Well, I got one more for you.
All right.
So you're going to, then you can come up for air.
All right.
So yeah, you've heard from critics and other developers and reviewers, but this is from a writer.
Hi, this is Tom Bissell, friend to Michael, friend to Steve, friend of the show, longtime listener, and occasional guest. I would like to join the chorus and congratulate Steve and his wonderful team for making, you know, one of my favorite games I think I've ever played. A lot of us have fantasized about, you know, what would a game without a traditionally, quote-unquote, exciting sort of gameplay hook look like? Would it be absorbing? Would it be interesting? And the thing that I love about Gone Home, and the thing that I will draw sustenance and, I hope, artistic courage from as I go forward, is that you can make something really exciting, really gripping, really profound, without all of the kind of traditional accoutrement of the video game apparatus. I'm sick with admiration for it. I love that it manages to touch emotions and feelings that have been more traditionally consigned to, like, short fiction or independent film. It proves beyond a doubt that the video game is a marvelous, wonderful, deep, and profound medium of expression. And thank you, all of you, for making it.
That means a lot to me. Tom is a great guy, and he's really smart, and his writing on games has really inspired me. And yeah, to make an impression on someone that thinks that deeply about games is really, really cool.
Well, I did. There's one sheet of paper I found in a drawer.
How big is this room?
Why
did you put the duck on the toilet? Why were you flushing that toilet?
I don't know. This? I'm telling you, it's user generated content. I'm not in control of it. It's out of your hands.
All right.
It's what, you know, users, you don't know what they're going to do. I found this one last piece of paper. It's typewritten. It's from Cameron Kunzelman. Cameron's one of the best critics. He's also a designer who writes really thoughtful stuff on his blog, This Cage is Worms. He's also written for 5 Out of 10 magazine. And I think his phone's broken, so he wasn't able to leave a message. But he did put this piece of paper in a drawer. And this is what he wrote. I didn't grow up as a white middle-class girl in Portland who discovered herself and her sexuality. So I can't say that Gone Home told a story that I have any inherent emotional attachment to. What I can say is that Gone Home reached across that experiential gap and grabbed hold of me. And at the end of 2 hours, I wasn't sure if it was clinging to me or I was clinging to it. I've sat here for more than 10 minutes trying to find words to explain what Gone Home did to me, has done to me, is still doing to me, and I can't come up with anything other than a great well and surge of emotion. Gone Home is a river in the dark. Gone Home expands and contracts and grows in time, like a fungus or like love. Gone Home, days later, keeps resonating, a beat, a song that I can't stop singing. So, Steve, you know, when we do podcasts with developers and people interview them, it's always picking your brain and finding out what you think and why did you do it and, you know, explaining this or that. And we've done some of that. But part of the function of this particular podcast was just for a bunch of us to say thank you to you and to your team, because we love your game and we think it's important.
I literally can't express how much we all appreciate that on the team. And I'm really excited for the rest of the people that have worked on the game to listen to this podcast, because maybe they won't find it as embarrassing because it's not in real time. They can hear me feeling unable to respond to such incredibly kind words about the work that we've done. And I mean, just know that in no way do we take it for granted. It's incredibly important to us. It means so much to know that the game is connected with people. So I appreciate you doing all this work to trick or bribe or otherwise coerce these people into saying that about our game. But
I just hit the play button, Steve. There was just an answering machine. I just hit the play button. So you know what? I did overlook one other message. I can't believe it.
House of Leaves, monster game, and it was never really an inspiration for me. But now this room just keeps going.
Well, this is, I promise, the very last one. This is different from all the others. This one, if you start the game in this room, it really puts a different perspective on the game.
Hi, Mom. So I got my ticket home from Europe, and wow, I'm sorry. I totally have the wrong number, don't I? Please disregard this voicemail. But, do have a nice day? Ugh, God, Katie, a way to waste an international call.
That was adorable. And yeah, we are really glad that we got to work with Sarah Omala. She did the voice of Katie on the answering machine at the beginning. She also did scratch recording for us. She did the first version of Sam's voice, which was incredibly valuable and important to the game, just to hear her in the level for us to go forward from. And we're so happy to have her voice in the game as the very first thing that you hear to pull you into the experience. So, you know, thank you again to Sarah for contributing the first voice that you encounter in Gone Home.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, and
thanks again for going home. And we're just, I think many of us who followed your work and or know about you from your appearances on podcasts and things feel a certain kind of investment in Gone Home and hope for your success. And, you know, it's always good too when somebody you admire turns out something really good. You know, it's kind of embarrassing when it can be a little awkward when it goes
you're
the other way.
Me. Oh, no. Okay. Well, you also managed to make it embarrassing and awkward for me today.
That was my job. Almost my whole job.
No, I appreciate it. It's a really, really sweet gesture. And thank you, everybody, that took time to share their thoughts for the show. That was really cool. Yeah, just know how humbling it is to hear smart people are doing awesome stuff say that kind of stuff about something that we made. So thank you very much.
Of course. Well, best of luck, and thanks again for your time, and happy gaming.
Thanks, Michael. You too.